morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Saipan Island is nearly 1,500 miles northwest of Earhart's destination at Howland Island. Yet Jesus Salas, a Saipanese farmer, recalls an incident in the Garapan prison on Saipan. In 1937, while a prisoner of the occupying Japanese army, Salas sees a white woman in the cell next to him. She is held there for several hours. Prison guards tell Salas that she is a captured American pilot. Salas never sees her again. Jose Pangelin, a grocer on Saipan, remembers seeing a white woman on the second floor of a compound hotel several times. He hears that she is a captured pilot and spy. These native Saipanese, Joaquin Seaman and Ben Salas, tell Gurner of hearing that an American woman was buried in this cemetery sometime in 1937. Gurner excavates several grave sites, but finds no proof.
The strongest evidence to me is the eyewitness reports on the island of Saipan. To me, it is inconceivable that these people were not telling the truth, and it is inconceivable to me that anyone else answering those descriptions was on that island at that time.
This is kind of like hidden history that I'm hoping to get out. Rob Ellis is the definition of a dedicated Amelia Earhart researcher, and he's put that dedication to good use. Over the years, Rob has become an Amelia Earhart presentation expert, giving his presentations to a variety of audiences, from kindergarten to retirees. Depending on the audience, Rob tailors his presentations by discussing Amelia's impact, legacy, and connection to children, as well as the disappearance case and the Japanese capture hypothesis in unique and groundbreaking ways that leave a lasting impact on any audience he presents to. In the 35th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Rob joins us via Zoom from his home in Minnesota to discuss the art of the Amelia Earhart presentation, the Japanese capture hypothesis and its many key witnesses and artifacts, and why he believes he knows what really happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan.
Our guest today is Rob Ellis. He does a very fascinating presentation on Amelia Earhart, and he's been doing it for quite some time. He's logged quite a few hours and a lot of presentations on Amelia. He's a very passionate and enthusiastic Amelia Earhart fan, and really just someone that is really a big asset to the project. So, Rob, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast today.
I'm glad to be here.
So let's start this out as we've done every episode we've ever done. Can you tell everybody out there that's listening a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
A master's of science degree from the University of Houston. When I came out of there, I worked giving science and nature programs at elementary schools for Burris Research Associates. They had me give a talk called The Future of Space Exploration for about 4 or 5 years. And then I started my own business basically doing the same thing. Went on to other things as well, other topics as well.
So let me ask you this, and this is going to be an interesting question, I think, but what are your earliest recollections of Amelia Earhart? When did she come into your life originally?
Probably grade school, having read about her and Lindbergh and other flyers and such like that.
And when did that sort of, that introduction sort of, when did you turn to Amelia Earhart professionally when it came to giving your presentations? When did that all start for you? Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I was in a bookstore called Borders Books, and I've always been interested in aviation. And in the aviation section, I found a book called Amelia Shoe. And I started going through it, and it looked fascinating. So I went back home to the Stillwater Library and took the book out, and I started reading it, and that was just fascinating reading. I really liked it. Then I went to the Tiger website, and they had a bibliography there of all kinds of Earhart disappearance books, and so I started there and just got my hands on every book I could possibly get my hands on having to do with her disappearance. So then, around 2005, I thought, you know, I got to get this out. I think this would be a great talk to get this out for people. Initially, the book that really excited me was I Witnessed Amelia Earhart Incident by Thomas Devine. I really read that and I thought, boy, this is a compelling story. You know, this guy really tells a compelling story. And I thought, I want to get that out there. I started giving these talks in February of 2005, mostly to assisted living, pilots groups, libraries, senior centers, places like that. That's why I started giving this talk. And then I tried to get a hold of the writer of With Our Own Eyes, Eyewitnesses of the Final Days of Amelia Earhart, Mike Campbell with Thomas Devine. And when I called the publisher, they said, we're so sorry, but Mr. Devine has passed. But we can take your phone number and give it to Mike Campbell, and we'll see if he's interested in contacting you. Well, he did contact me. We talked a little bit on the phone, and then we started emails, and Mike Campbell has become a huge mentor to me. He has sent me thousands of emails. He introduced me to Robert Wallach. He nominated me as a member for the Amelia Earhart Research Association. I really can't thank him enough. He was a huge mentor for many years since 2005.
Yeah, it's a big shout out to Mike Campbell, who's done some incredible work over the years on his own blog, and we'll definitely put a link to his blog in the show notes for this particular episode as well.
Once I got into the Amelia Earhart Research Association, there were lots of other people that really helped me hone and refine my talk. Alex Mandel, Bill Primack, Ron Bright, Jackie Ferrari, Les Kinney, Donald Moyer Wilson, and Jim Crowder, and others. So I took my talk, which was a good talk initially, but, you know, needed some honing and refining, and these people really helped me out.
Let's backtrack a little bit. So you initially started giving these talks, you said, in 2005. How did you start to prepare? Do you remember the very first talk you gave, first of all, and how you started to prepare for that, and what research you did, and what you wanted it to have kind of look and feel-wise?
Yes. It was for a pilot's banquet at a golf course near here in Stillwater, and they paid me to come there and give my talk, which is entitled, I Know What Really Happened to Amelia Earhart. I had a text that I would read from. I had a model of her Electra. I had a suitcase similar to Robert Wallach's briefcase. I had the passports inside and her itinerary and papers to get in all those various countries. So I went with a lot of props. I learned very early on, when you're talking to people, they like to see stuff. So, you know, I got some newspaper headlines from the old days of, you know, Earhart lost in Pacific and things like this. So my talk started out real heavy on props, and I still continue to gain those two today. But the talk went well, and I just kept going from there and improving it all the time.
Now, you give talks to a wide variety of groups, all ages, am I right?
Yes, I do have a talk called Amelia Earhart, America's Most Famous Woman Pilot. I give it to preschoolers, 3s, 4s, and 5-year-olds. I give it to kindergarten through 4th grade in elementary schools. And it's prop heavy, just full of props. Kids especially like to see things, and I have a lot of things that tie in with Amelia Earhart, you know, her cat, her dog, the horses she liked to ride, you know, the Vega that she had, the tomato juice she liked to drink, and, you know, everything. I have a lot of props to hold up, and I just talk from those props, and I've gotten some great artwork through the years from some of them, especially Farnsworth Elementary School in St. Paul. They've sent, the 4th graders there have sent me some beautiful artwork about Amelia. Generally shows like a red Vega in the sky, and there's a dark cloud, and there's lightning coming out of it, and, you know, Amelia's trying to control the plane, but it's really great art, you know. So it's been very valuable to me to go to the schools and get these ideas across. They do study Earhart, by the way, in both kindergarten and 4th grade at that school.
That's great. I'm really happy to hear that. We've had a lot of project guests that are, you know, that are telling us that they're still studying her and they're still talking about her, you know, from various aspects, from kindergarten all the way up to 4th and 5th grade. So that's great to hear that. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, and just as you're talking there, is, and you talk about your props and kind of the importance of the visuals and everything, can you talk a little bit about kind of how you, like, I guess what differentiates a presentation you would give to a group of, let's say, fourth graders, and you compare that to a group of aviation military personnel and things like that. I mean, obviously the topics are very different. You talk more about the disappearance maybe for the older folks that are kind of in that. And then for the younger kids, you talk about really the woman that she was and her.
Yeah, her career, what she was like as a little girl, that kind of things. So they're two completely different talks. And I really don't talk about the disappearance at all to the children, other than I hold the Electra up and I say, you know, she made her way quite a bit around the world and then disappeared. And I leave it at that. And then if they bring up questions, you know, what I think happened, you know, I talked to them about the Marshall Islands and Saipan, because that's the one I think is where the truth is.
How important do you think it is for, you know, you mentioned that you kind of, you know, you hold up the prop of the Electra and then you say that she made it almost all the way around and then her and Mr. Noonan disappeared. And you sort of leave it on that cliffhanger for kids. How important do you think it is that you do it that way? Is it important to sort of leave kids sort of wondering and kind of nurture that wonderment and that kind of imagination of maybe someone that would want to be a future investigator or someone that wants to look into this more on their own?
Sure. This would encourage research rather than giving them an answer saying, hey, here's what happened. You know, they went into the drink or whatever. If you leave it open-ended, then they tend to want to do some research.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so let's shift a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the different hypotheses that have been kind of worked in the span of the last, well, since the 1960s, early 1960s, really since she disappeared. But I mean, kind of hit the forefront in the early 1960s, and now it's hotter than ever. But I want to ask you about something very specific, something about the Japanese capture hypothesis that fascinates me personally. And mm-hmm. that is, and I like to call it Robert Wallach's briefcase. I know it's not his briefcase, but it's
right.
I associate it with Robert Wallach, obviously, all these years.
Yes. Now.
Can you just tell, we've had some folks, you know, some guests of our show kind of talk about the briefcase a little bit, but I think you'd be a great person to kind of dive into that a little more in detail. Can you tell us first, give us an overview of what Robert Wallach's briefcase is, and can you tell us everything really sort of that you know about that briefcase or that we know as the public at this point?
Sure. Well, Robert was coming ashore. And I've got a nice picture that I hold up of him from Leatherneck magazine of him and his buddy crawling on the shore, coming ashore on Saipan. The reason they're crawling on their hands and knees is Robert said bullets were flying over their head, shrapnel was everywhere, mortars were going off nearby. But he did make it in through. But they went on to, he was a machine gunner, and they went on to Mount Tapachao. As they started going up there, he got shot in his right hand, which was a shooting hand. So Robert was sent back with the stragglers and the wounded, you know, those that didn't have to go on a medical ship or anything, but still stayed on the island. And they kind of hung around near Garapan City, the capital of Saipan. And one day Robert said that they were looking around. Him and 10 of his friends were looking around for souvenirs and stuff. And they came to a building that looked like maybe some kind of administration building. And they saw a lot of broken steel, concrete, wood, you know, just dirt, you know, it didn't look like much. And they're about ready to leave, but they looked back in the corner and the roof was being held up by something. The roof had collapsed, but it was being held up by something in a corner. And I thought, well, wait a minute. So they went back there and they pulled off the tar paper and they pulled off the shingles and the wood and they found a safe. Robert told me the safe was about 6 feet tall, about 4 feet wide. It had two doors and a handle and a lock. It was locked. So they had a demolition person there with some gel that he put on the lock, and they all stood at a safe distance. And all was quiet. Nothing was heard. But suddenly, there was a giant explosion. Dust and debris filled the air. And Robert said when all of the dust cleared, he was the first one in, and he reached up on a top shelf, and he pulled out a briefcase. And the first comment he had is, guys, we're all going to be rich.
Yeah, he thought he was going to be a rich man at that point.
Millions, millions of Japanese yen in here. We're going to be rich with Japanese yen. So they started to open it, but to his surprise, there was no money in there. Instead were Amelia Earhart's passports to get in out of various countries, her flight itinerary showing, you know, just where they would fly around the world, various types of health papers and things to get in and out of countries. And he was puzzled. He thought, what's this stuff doing up here? I thought she went down in a drink And these papers are bone dry. These papers have never been underwater. What are they doing up here in Saipan? So Robert decided that he was going to try and keep it. But his buddies kept telling Robert, you can't keep this. This is too important. They won't let you keep this. They won't let you. So they talked him into going down to the shore and giving the briefcase to a officer. Now, officers on Saipan did not wear rank because snipers would try to take them out first. But this man, Robert said, had little scrambled eggs like on the top of his hat, which was a symbol of authority. And he gave him the briefcase, and the man actually wrote on a note, received from Robert E. Wallach, Amelia Earhart's briefcase, passports, permits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Robert put that note in his money belt, and he never saw the briefcase again. Well, somebody else did see the briefcase, though, at the command post, near a tent inside the command post. Julius Ernest Neighbors saw the person that we now know was James H. Nichols, known in the ONI as the Rabbit. He saw him go in there and grab it and take it. And so the briefcase was seen by at least one other person other than Robert Wallach. But so that's Robert's story.
And he maintained that story all the way up. And we've watched the fantastic footage of Robert Wallach and, you know, all that stuff that was shot where he was talked about that. You know, he maintained it all the way up to his death, basically, that this is what happened and this is what I saw. My question was, you mentioned the note. Did he lose that note with that receipt, or did he produce that note ever?
No, here's what happened. Robert, I believe, went to Okinawa next, and he got shot and had a bad leg injury. And they were pulling off his pants, and he pulled off his money belt, and he was telling them, save the money belt, save the money belt. But in the effort to save his life, the money belt was gone. So, real bummer there. Yeah. So he had that note, but he was telling them, save the money belt, save the money belt. He was just screaming.
Now, Rob, has any work been done, and I know you would know this more than I, but has any work been done in trying to sort of reverse engineer kind of the process of who he gave that briefcase to, what they might have done with that briefcase, and where that briefcase might maybe be today? If it's it's a really kind of a long shot, but has there ever been any work as far as the process of maybe the traveling of the briefcase and where that briefcase may have ended up?
I've not seen any. There could be some, but I've not seen any. Again, Julius Neighbors was the person who saw James H. Nichols grab it in that command post tent by the little tree. He said, I remember thoroughly that it was sitting right there, and he came in and Nichols grabbed it. Now, I would say maybe it's in the National Archives, something like that. It's just hard to say. I've never seen a paper trail.
What do you think the odds are that briefcase still exists?
I think the odds are very high. It's quite an artifact.
Let's talk about Julius Neighbors, because you've name-dropped him a couple times. And he's another very important figure when it comes to Amelia Earhart lore and the research on Saipan and those islands, Marshall Islands. Tell everybody who Julius Neighbors is and how he factors into this particular story.
Okay, Julius Neighbors was a code clerk on Saipan, and he listened to some communications of the 5th Amphibian Corps, and he decoded a message saying that they found Amelia Earhart's plane on Saipan. This is when he was on Saipan. So anyhow, he also later heard them say that they were gonna fly Amelia Earhart's plane. So next, they actually had him come in guard the plane. This is a big thing of his testimony. Julius Neighbors was to guard the plane 24 hours through the night and everything. And Amelia's plane was inside the locker and it was padlocked and nobody was supposed to go in. And he actually stood guard there. And he said, during the night, some army brass came up in a Jeep and they said, we want to see Amelia Earhart's plane. And he said, sorry, but orders is orders. You can't go in. And they said, your orders will shortly be changed. And they took off and he never saw them again.
Did he ever personally lay eyes on the plane?
Yes, he did. He saw the plane flying. If you go to Rich Martini's Earhart on Saipan site. It's simply called Earhart on Saipan, Rich Martini. Julius Neighbors actually puts his arms out like a plane, and he mentioned how it was flying, and, you know, not flying very well, but it was flying. Alan Raver and other troops that were going through Saipan said they saw a silver twin-engine civilian airplane flying low like it was in trouble. And it wasn't flying well, but they wondered, what is this civilian plane doing out here in a war zone? You know, they were surprised by it. And then they were marching by an area of airplanes, and there was a person that was quite an Earhart aficionado. And he looked to his right, and he saw Earhart's airplane. And this is in Mike Campbell's book, Truth at Last. He knew it was their plane, and he said he was just aghast. He couldn't believe it. Amelius Earhart's airplane was right there, and he knew it was their plane because he was such an aficionado of Amelia Earhart.
So let's talk about this because it's important, I think. I mean, it's the holy grail of aviation. I think a lot of our guests would agree with that statement. So I'm just going to ask you flat out, what happened to Amelia Earhart's plane?
Well, about a day later or 2 days later, Julius Neighbors heard that they were going to destroy Amelia Earhart's airplane. And he went there and he stood in the distance. And at the same time, Tom Devine ran low as not to be seen. And he stood at a distance. And James H. Nichols came and they pulled the Electra out of a locker. They put several cans of avgas on the airplane, and strafing bullets were heard, and the plane went up in a big ball of flame, and it burned and burned, and Neighbors saw it, some other troops that are in Mike Campbell's book saw it, and so anyhow, 9 months later, Tom Devine went back, and it was still there. Her plane was still there, but as a scorched, twisted framework. That's all that was left. Some other people have said, and this eventually it was pushed into a big pile of airplane motors in a big hole in the ground and covered over. So some people think it's probably under or near the Saipan International Airport. But boy, how you would find that with all those other motors and things in there, that could be hard.
Now, you've name-dropped another gentleman, James S. Nichols, a couple of times throughout this podcast. Can you tell everybody, let's do the same treatment for Mr. Nichols. Can you tell everybody who James Nichols was? And I know he's factored in a little bit, but tell everybody his story.
Well, I'm not going to tell his story, but I'm going to read from something because this is an interesting letter. This is a letter from Art Beach, August 10th, 2003, letter to Rich Martini. Dear sir, I had an uncle who spent a lot of time in the Navy and was in some sort of secret service. He died in the 60s. Not long before he died, he told my dad how he was sent to the task force about to invade Saipan. He was to recover what he could of Amelia Earhart, bring her back if she was alive, and destroy everything if she was dead. He recovered her diary and some other papers. He saw her plane fly twice while he was getting the papers. He went to the admiral, and a plane was put in an empty hangar with guards on the doors. Late in the day, he went to the hangar and dumped 2 5-gallon cans of avgas on it, and the plane was lit. The government not only knew they were there, but it sent a man there to hide or destroy all sign of them. That's a letter to Rich Martini.
And that letter was written by?
Art Beach. I have a picture of Art Beach, or Art Beach's dad, standing by James Nichols on an old car. And I also have another picture of him, and Les Kinney has these pictures too. He was definitely identified by Julius Neighbors as definitely, you know, the man that he saw involved with the plane and everything. He eventually, he quit the ONI because his statement was, boy, if they can get Forrestal, they can get me. And some feel that James Vincent Forrestal did not kill himself throwing him outside of the Bethesda, Maryland Naval Hospital, but he was pushed. So that was his thing. When he quit the ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, James H. Nichols said, if they can get Forrestal, they can get me. I'm getting out. But he was known as the rabbit. He was very well. They let him do a lot of things on his own because he was very, very skilled at gathering intelligence.
Now, let's backtrack a little bit because we've talked about Amelia and Fred being on the Marshals, being in Saipan and the eyewitnesses in the military and all that stuff that we've covered so far. But a lot of people want to know, how did she get there? What was the course of action that caused Amelia and Fred to end up in the Marshall Islands?
Natives at the Marshall Islands heard a plane approaching, and it was low to the water. It was a silver twin-engine plane approaching low to the water like it was out of gas. They saw a big splash offshore near Bear Island and Endocrine Island. And then Gerardo Alibar and his friend Lee Jean hid in the grass to see what was going on there. Pretty soon, they saw two individuals come out of the plane, and they got in a yellow boat that grew. Obviously, the natives had never seen a inflatable raft before, but that's what they call it. They got in a yellow boat that grew. And we know Erard had a yellow safety raft with her. So anyhow, they came ashore, and they buried a silver container near a canal tree. Later on, some Japanese soldiers arrived and started arguing with the two men. But then one of the Japanese slapped one of the men, but he screamed at the voice of a woman. So they looked really closely, and sure enough, it was a woman with hair cut short like a man. Now, later on, of course, they were sent by plane over to Jaluit first. Noonan had probably sustained an injury when he landed. When they got over to Jaluit, Billon Amaron was a medical corpsman. He was about, somewhere between 16 to 18 years old. And a chief medical doctor took him out to a ship that came in one day to treat a man and a woman. The woman sitting on a deck chair had hair cut short like a man and trousers, and she was sitting on a deck chair, and she did not appear to be in duress or anything. The man was sitting on a hatch cover, and he was very tall, and Billamon was very surprised because the man had blue eyes, and Billamon had never seen a person with blue eyes before in his life. And he treated a cut on his knee with a flexible bandage called Paraply, and then he put a bandage around his head for a cut that he had on his head. Next, they were seen up in Kwajalein. A woman and a man were seen walking across the causeway between Roy and Amur, and the man had a big white bandage around his head. Mike Campbell has done some research from a publication called the Kwajalein Hourglass that said that a Mrs. Mara Phillips cooked and translated for Amelia while she was there, and a John Tobiki also had seen her there. Furthermore, they must have came there in a Japanese seaplane because there was an old fella that took one researcher out to the end of the island, and he pointed out between some trees and a house. And he said, look, halfway between the trees and a house, that's where the seaplane landed, and I had to go out in a boat and bring them back. And all that I know is they said that they were spies. And one was a woman, one was a man, and he said, that's all that I know. I would assume they flew later from Kwajalein to Saipan and landed by seaplane near in Tanapeg Harbor, because there's a person I've talked to with twice in 2017. Her name is Josephine Blanco Akiyama. I've talked with her twice, and she's a real nice person and very believable. She said one day she was driving her bicycle to Tanapeg Harbor, and she came to the restricted area and showed her passport. And she was taking lunch to her brother-in-law, Jose Matsumoto. And she saw a seaplane land in there, and some people came out. And pretty soon, Jose said, come see the American woman. Come see the American woman. And she said she saw a woman with hair cut short like a man, wearing trousers, standing next to a tall, thin man. Later on, some photographs were shown to her by Earhart researchers, and she easily picked Amelia out of about 10 women. She says, there, right there, you know, that was her. So that's how they got to Saipan, probably on a Japanese seaplane.
Let's talk about Garapan Prison, because I know that's a really famous location in Earhart research and lore. Can you tell everybody about Garapan Prison and what your thoughts are on that particular location?
There are actually two parts of the prison. They actually had one part where they held female prisoners, and they also had another part where all sorts of prisoners. Now, my friend Jim Crowder from St. Paul, Minnesota, he lived during the Peace Corps. He lived on Majuro and also on Saipan. And he said he talked to a sister Angelica who was in prison briefly, and she used to see Amelia there. Her and Amelia would be let out in the courtyard to walk around to get some exercise and fresh air. And generally they'd smile at each other and nod, but they didn't really have a chance to talk. But she did know that her name was Amelia. Sister Remedios Castro also said that she had been told that the woman's name was Amelia. Now, for many years, when people have gone to Garapan Prison, that's one of the highlights that people have been shown. The tour guide say, this is a cell where Amelia Earhart was held. So that's where the prison was. It wasn't in good shape. It hasn't been in good shape for years and years, and looked like it really would have been a bad place to stay.
Let me just ask you this again, another flat out question, because it floats around a lot, and you've mentioned it a little bit in this episode of the show, but were Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan spies for the U.S. government?
I don't think they were spies, but I could be wrong. The president, FDR, could have told them to be looking out for anything they saw, kind of like white intelligence. They knew they'd be flying over Africa, Khartoum, a lot of different places where U.S. military hadn't been before. So it wasn't just the areas where they ended up in, but all during their flight, they probably had their eyes open to see what size the airfields were. Did they have military components, you know, things like this. So probably I would say some white intelligence, not spy per se. On the other hand, there is the Morgenthau statement, and there are some other things that point to, you know, Amelia telling a friend, can you imagine that? Me being a spy? So I'm just going to leave it out there. But I really don't think she was spying, but I could be wrong.
You know, it's interesting. President Trump just not too long ago released the JFK files, that made big news, you know, some previously unreleased photos and files and things like that when it comes to the John F. Kennedy assassination case. He obviously would, if anybody would have the power to make that same decision regarding Amelia Earhart. And there's obviously a great interest. If the Lost Evidence documentary this summer proved anything, it's the world still very much is invested in the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred.
Sure.
Do you think in our lifetime, or even in this presidency possibly, that we'll see Donald Trump possibly release new information or maybe make all those secret files on Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan available to the public, or at least available to certain people?
I'm not sure. I'm unsure of the man. So I don't know what he would do. I haven't sent him a letter. I sent letters to President George Bush. I sent two letters, both administrations of Barack Obama, asking that all classified and unclassified files be released, any artifacts, anything to do. I mentioned Sunshine Week. You know, Mr. Obama said that, you know, he wants to have more transparency in government. Well, this would be a good example of transparency. You know, show us the hidden history. Show us what happened to Amelia Earhart. This is a really big thing for the history book. So I sent three letters, one to Bush, two to Obama, and I haven't sent one to Trump. I'm not sure what he would do with it.
What were the results of those letters that you sent to the presidents? Did you hear back from the White House at all?
I only heard back one time from Obama, and it was more or less just trying to mention his next upcoming campaign. It really had nothing to do with Earhart. But I did send a letter to Senator Dayton, who is now Governor Dayton in Minnesota here. And he sent back a nice letter, and he said, unfortunately, I don't have the kind of clearance or ability to look into those kinds of files and have them released. So that was the best letter I got back of all.
Let me ask you this, and this is just purely speculation, I think, at this point. But if, let's say, next week, everything was released and it was made public, and it was confirmed, absolute confirmation, that Amelia and Fred ended up on the Marshall Islands and eventually were executed on the island of Saipan or one of those islands, depending on, you know, what the actual information says. What do you think that does to the legacy of Amelia Earhart, and how does that change things for her legacy? And do you think it has an effect on the legacy of FDR and really just sort of everything we knew about him as a president and really about Amelia as a person? What do you think that does? How does that change things?
I don't think it would change Amelia's legacy, given there's, other than the Morgenthau statement, there's been no papers out there saying that Amelia did anything wrong during her entire flight. On the other hand, of FDR, it could be really hard on his legacy. FDR, you know, many people consider him a good president. My dad was in the CCC. My dad was out of work in a depression, didn't have any money, and had a family to support. Well, FDR made the Civilian Conservation Corps, and I still remember the trees by Ashland, Wisconsin, going towards Duluth there, where my dad planted those trees. And, you know, they're a snow block. They keep the drifting snow up there from blowing across the road. He also created Social Security, which is still benefiting millions and millions. And he got us out of the Great Depression. So many do consider him a great president, but if it comes out that he had abandoned Earhart Noonan, that would tarnish it. But I'm kind of a little torn on it because, you know, you can't really go to a big giant war in the Pacific over two people. Les Kinney said that by around August of 1937, or maybe at the farthest, the fall of 1937, they would have gone through the broken Japanese codes and have found that Earhart and Noonan were in captivity. You know, there was really nothing he could do. You had to keep your mouth shut. You just can't go in a huge war over two people. You can't. So you keep your mouth shut. Now, in 1944, the soldiers at Ashland Field following Amelia Earhart's Electra in Lockheed Electra in the hangar, and once again he was in trouble. A person named David Finlayson was a page in Washington, D.C., and he walked in on a conversation between Henry Wallace, Henry Truman, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he heard them say they found Amelia's plane. And after a little bit of a discussion, Finlayson said, destroy the airplane. You know, so Roosevelt had it destroyed. Now, at the time, in 1944, FDR was in a tough battle with Thomas Dewey for the presidency. If any word got out about the Electra or abandoning Earhart Noonan in 37, that would have been it. That would have been the end of the election. He would not have won his fourth term. So again, he kept quiet about it. He had the plane destroyed. So, and now, of course, we're in a different situation now. Right now, we've got several reasons to keep quiet about Earhart Noonan. First of all, breaking of the Japanese codes, that's a no-no. We could not, back in 1937, if we knew through the broken Japanese codes that Earhart Noonan were in captivity, we could not have hinted in any way that that's how we knew. And that was a huge strategic military advantage that we had broken the Japanese naval codes. We couldn't say, we know you have Earhart in captivity. They would have changed their code. So we couldn't do that. You know, we had a lot of isolationists at the time, including Lindbergh, going around the country saying, hey, let's stay out of these foreign wars. The Atlantic will protect us, the Pacific will protect us, and, you know, keep our boys stateside here. So there was no real wanting to go over into war over there. And now, currently, you know, what we try to do at the moment is maintain the excellent political, economic, and military relations we have with Japan. We have six U.S. bases on Japanese soil. You got scary North Korea and China right off the border there. And so we want to keep that there. You know, that's the reason I think right now we don't want to come up with it. You know, we already shamed Japan about the comfort women. We shamed Japan about the rape of Nanking. We shamed Japan about Dr. Ichii and his chemical and biological weapon experiments on people. Well, Amelia Earhart was our sweetheart. She's a lot closer to our heart. This is just a dog they want to let lay. I don't think they want to get into this.
You know, you mentioned something early on, and it's totally unrelated to the disappearance case, but there's a lot of rumor and innuendo about this, and I don't know if you know about this, but you mentioned that FDR, during his presidency, that Social Security was established. Any truth to the rumor and innuendo that Amelia Earhart sort of was the kind of the bug in his ear about Social Security, and that she kind of had that idea, and FDR took it and ran with it? Any have you ever heard about anything like that?
No, I haven't heard that.
Okay. Interesting. You know, it's something we've heard floating around, and we haven't been able to verify that yet. So we thought we'd ask. The last sort of, I don't want to say witness, but, you know, really kind of one of the prime witnesses, I think, for the Japanese capture hypothesis as a whole is a gentleman by the name of Admiral Chester Nimitz.
Yes.
And this is a pretty interesting guy, and I'm wondering if you can tell everybody a little bit about Admiral Nimitz and how he comes into play, and just what, you know, he felt about Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan being on the Marshall Islands.
Well, Nimitz was encouraging Gorner, is what it was. When Fred Gorner was over there looking around, Chester Nimitz, you know, told him, stay on track, you're really on to something. In fact, Nimitz told Gorder that he was onto something that would stagger his imagination. And for years in Fredericksburg, Texas, in the Nimitz Museum, there was a sign. It's been taken down now. I don't know who did it, but there was a sign saying, "Now that you're going to Washington, Fred, I can tell you that Earhart and the Navigator did go down in the Marshalls and were captured by the Japanese." Chester Nimitz. That was a sign in his museum in Fredericksburg, Texas, but the sign is now gone. Also, the sign has disappeared from the jail in Saipan that mentioned Amelia Earhart's cell. I don't know where these signs have gone to, but somebody obviously doesn't like these signs around.
Now, we've covered the Marshall Islands Japanese capture hypothesis pretty extensively in this particular conversation, but you've also got some really interesting sort of observations on some of the other major hypotheses that are kind of going around and are being worked currently and have been worked for so long. Did you want to go into that a little bit and just sort of tell everybody kind of some of your thoughts on those particular hypotheses?
Sure. First of all, is the Bolem theory. That's that repatriation that Amelia Earhart was brought back to the United States alive, and she was repatriated, but turned in her identity changed into a New Jersey housewife named Irene Bolem. Now, the first point I'd like to state is this. Ron Bright said he interviewed Eleanor Smith, a contemporary of Amelia Earhart, and Eleanor Smith said she had to look up to talk to Amelia Earhart, but look straight ahead to talk to Irene Bolem, and knowing both of them, said they were two separate people. And Alex Mandel said that Michelle Cervone had an aviation form from a competition that she found on eBay, and it had both Amelia's full name and Irene Bolem's full name on the same sheet. Also, you have this Dr. Oscar Tosi. He's a voice identification expert. He compared Amelia Earhart and Bolem's voices. He's from Michigan State University, Department of Voice Identification, and they claim his system is as valid as fingerprints and was upheld in many courts in the U.S. and abroad. And many consider him to be the world's foremost expert on voice ID. He did tests of Earhart's voice and Bolem's test, and he said it's two different people. The numbers he got were 55 and 55. For them to be identical person, it'd have to be somewhere above 95 to up to 100. So he says these are two completely different people. Kevin Richland was a detective out west, and this is what he said. This is very, very interesting. In comparing Bolem and Earhart, there are numerous differences, Richland began. The age line on Earhart starts at her nose, proceeds down past the edge of her mouth, and there's a second groove that goes from her mouth down. In Bolem, the age line starts at the nose, but only goes down partway and stops well short of the edge of her mouth, and there is no second groove. Richland also went on to show Earhart has a mole and freckles, whereas Bolem has no mole and no freckles. Furthermore, their eyebrows are different, their noses are different, and their mouths are different. Richland continued illustrating these distinctions by using a pointer to trace them in comparison photos, and his conclusion was, these are two different people.
Now, let me play the devil's advocate here. Everything you've talked about right now as far as like the actual comparison and the voice analytics and the looking up as opposed to looking straight ahead. When Irene Bolem sort of came into the forefront of all this was 1970, around that time, when the book came out and when she kind of was thrust into the spotlight and had to kind of sort of defiantly defend herself as not being Amelia Earhart. From 1937 to 1970, that's an awfully long time. Is it possible that voices change and that, stature of people change? I know that happens all the time. So when you're looking at comparison like that, wouldn't it be a better comparison for someone to look at Irene Bolem as she was in a certain age at a certain time and Amelia Earhart as opposed to Irene Bolem when she was 40 years older than Amelia Earhart was when she disappeared? So that's kind of what I was always curious about when it comes to, all these folks that are sort of making these statements about, the voice being inaccurate. Well, of course, the voice is not going to be the same for a woman that's 40 years older than a woman that you have a recorded voice for. It's going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are actually different pictures in some text showing Irene Bolam standing next to friends when she was younger, and from driver's license, they knew the friend's height. And from that, they could infer what Irene Bolam's height was. And it definitely was shorter than Amelia's height at that time. I also want to share you something that Bill Primack told me before he died. The former Bill Primack of the Amelia Earhart Society, he said that one time him and Joe Gervais were riding along the east coast of the United States somewhere, and Bill Primack knew of a woman that had grown up with Irene Bolam and knew her really, really well. You know, knew her really, really well. And so Bill recommended that him and Joe Gervais go over there. It was just about 20 miles away from where they were, and meet and talk with her. Joe Gervais got rather upset. He said, "I don't want to do it." And he told Bill Primack, "I want you to swear that you'll never tell anybody about this." And they kept driving. I'm just making that as, again, something Bill Primack told me. And there are many people I have here on my right-hand side here. Here's the Acheson report. Amelia Earhart's Survival and Repatriation, Myth or Reality, a report by Alex Mandel, edited by Mike Campbell. Irene Bolam lived a very regular life that is well documented. You can find that, you know, she was Irene Bolam. She was incensed when they tried to call her a fake when she was on TV. I remember she was holding a book, and she was just indignant. "I am not Amelia Earhart," she said, with all the firmness, you know, she could muster. Imagine people calling you a fake. You're not who you claim to be. And the inference is even worse. Bolam is not only Amelia Earhart, but she has deliberately deceived millions by hiding in her new identity. What a cut, what a slander of Irene Bolam's character. I can see why she wanted to sue Klass and Gervais and not participate in any of their nonsense. You know, she was just very incensed that they were saying she was a fake.
So who was Irene Bolam?
She married a person named Guy Bolam. I don't know much about her. I have the book right here, Amelia Earhart Lives. I've read the book, and I've taken a lot of notes and things. You know, I've just been very skeptical, and the reason I don't know a lot about Irene Bolam is I've always thought it's just kind of a distraction from what seems to me the most likely truth of things is the Marshall and Saipan. So I haven't put a lot into studying Irene Bolam.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit to the crash and sink hypothesis, which is the official, basically the official story that's endorsed by the United States government to this day. And it's been endorsed by a lot of folks who've done a lot of great work on that particular hypothesis and have been researching for that for decades and decades. Let's talk a little bit about that particular hypothesis and what your observations are on that.
Well, the crash and sink, it could have some merit to it because the ocean is rather deep. The thing is they never found any oil slick. They never found any floating tires. They never found any floating debris, life jackets, their raft. They were supposed to have a Very pistol. There was a lot of stuff they had on that plane for survival. So nothing was ever found. But it is a big, big ocean. And there's waves that conceal things from people. So that theory, I'm not real hard on the theory because it's still possible that the plane went in a drink and somehow they sank quickly or after a day or so. But I don't give it that much good credence because of the Marshall Islands and Saipan. Remember, Marshall Islands and Saipan, there are 49 named eyewitnesses that either saw Amelia or Fred or Amelia and Fred together, or her plane, or her briefcase, or her suitcase up in Kwajalein, or other artifacts. A man picked out of a wallet of a dead Japanese soldier. He had a picture of a thin, haggard-looking Earhart being guarded by some guards. And he had that picture. He found that on a Japanese soldier in his wallet. But sadly, he lost a photo in an invasion of Tinian. Some other GIs had seen a picture of Earhart standing by an aircraft, again, looking thin and haggard. There's another picture showing Earhart and Noonan under guard. The people that had these last two pictures, they said, "We still have them." And but they searched their attic, and they searched their attic, and they looked and looked and looked and looked and looked, and they just could not find them. But so you have 49 people that accurately described what Earhart and Noonan looked like, their plane, artifacts, et cetera. So I don't think Crash and Sink is the way to go, but it has a possibility. The Gardner Island, Nico Island thing is such that it was said that they were castaways. Basically, they landed on Gardner Island, and they were castaways, and maybe radio broadcast for a while. Now, this was July 2nd, 1937, that they disappeared, and they would have been within distance to go to Gardner Island. But just 100 days later, in 1937, Henry E. Maude and a team of British surveyors landed on Gardner Island and conducted a full investigation of the island and lagoon. Nothing was found that would indicate Earhart and Fred Noonan's presence on the island. In 1938, a joint New Zealand and British team known as NZPAS, New Zealand Pacific Air Survey, headed by E.A. Gibson and Jim Henderson, landed on Gardner and conducted a full survey. They surveyed for the airfield and studied the possibilities of the use of the island for defense purposes. Nothing was found that would somehow indicate the presence of Earhart Noonan or the plane on the island. Then in 1939, Henry Maude returned to the Gardner with a full contingent of Gilbert Islanders settlers. And since then, the island has been continually inhabited until 1964. A village was built, thousands of coconut palms planted, even a post office was established. During all these activities, nothing was found that would somehow indicate the presence of Amelia Earhart or Fred Noonan on the island. In the same year, 1939, the U.S. Navy ship USS Bushnell surveyed Gardner for U.S. defense potential purposes. This survey included particularly aerial photos and mosaics of the island. Nothing concerning Earhart Noonan was found or reported. And lastly, in 1943, the U.S. Coast Guard built a Loran navigation station on Gardner. Vehicles, construction materials, and equipment were brought ashore, and this facility operated until well after the end of World War II, or at least till 1947. The Coast Guard personnel who served on the island during this period reported that every inch of the island was explored again and again, just because there was little else to do save the evening movie, and nothing relating to Earhart Fred Noonan was ever found or reported. Now, also, the USS Colorado arrived shortly after her disappearance. According to Ron Bright and others, they had a clear day. They flew at a height of about 400 feet. Les Kinney said they flew for about a half an hour or more, passes over the island, back and forth. Ron Bright said they had been instructed to look out for palm fronds in the sand, like a message, or sticks laying in sand as a rescue message, fires, things like this. They flew over at 400 feet. They clearly saw the wreck of the Norwich City, all rusty. But wherever they looked, they did not find anything. They saw some markers. One of them said he saw recent signs of recent habitation. Now, later on, Ron Bright went and interviewed that lieutenant. And he said, "What did you mean by signs of recent habitation?" He said, "Well, it was crumbling old building walls." That was likely to be one of the old guano mines, you know, Arundel guano mine. So you have all these people that have been on the island and no sight of Earhart Noonan or her plane. So I have real problems with the Nico Gardner Island scenario. I just have trouble with that because so many people are there, you would think they have seen them.
Let me kind of put this, and I don't think I've ever really put this question to anybody yet. Let's talk a little bit. We'll run through every one of the hypotheses and I'll break down sort of what each hypothesis sort of has. The Irene Bolam hypothesis has a lot of forensic work done on it, has a lot of handwriting analysis, voice analysis, things like that. Mm-hmm. The Nicomoro Gardner Island hypothesis, Tigers really built a really large, lengthy case of circumstantial evidence. They've really sort of been building a case on that island for the last 30 years. The Crash and Sink hypothesis has done an immense amount of work searching the ocean floors.
Not of course, yep.
Yeah, putting all that data together, and it's backed by the U.S. government as the official representation of what happened to Amelia and Fred. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese capture hypothesis is based off of a huge amount of eyewitness testimony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To sort of back it, and then now they have this first really piece of evidence when this photo that sort of kind of came about in the Summers Lost Evidence documentary. So you have four different major hypotheses, and you have four different types of evidence to back up the hypothesis that we're talking about. It's very, very interesting, I find. When you look at all of that, what if this is a court of public opinion and this is a jury trial case and the jury is public opinion, which one of these types of evidence holds the most weight in lieu of a smoking gun with all these different hypotheses?
I would say the Marshall Islands and Saipan, because you had so many eyewitnesses that described an unusually looking woman. Tall, thin woman with hair cut short like a man, wearing trousers like a man. They had been told she was a lady pilot. women pilots were unheard of in Japan. Actually, Gardner Island, Nikumaro, they've not brought back anything of merit to actually show it was from Aaron Noonan. They did have a skeleton as evidence. In 1940, Dr. Gallagher found a skeleton. He called them those ancient old bones, and measurements were taken by a forensic anthropologist, Dr. Hoodless. Now, Dr. Hoodless took the measurements. The skeleton is gone. We can't find it anymore, but we do have the measurements. And the most interesting thing I think I ever found is the late Patrick Gaston and Ron Bright did a big investigation into the skull of the skeleton, because Amelia Earhart had sinus problems all her life, trouble with her nose and stuff. So just a little while before the world flight, she went to an otolaryngologist, ear, nose specialist, and Ron Bright and Patrick Gaston got to talk to their son. And her son said that, yes, he, on Amelia Earhart, his dad had performed a Caldwell luck operation. And he said it was probably bilateral. So there would have been two dime-sized holes in her upper maxilla, upper part of her nose. And of course, Hoodless was a very competent anthropologist, and he noted on his report, no skeletal abnormalities. And the son said, although still would have been present by then, 3 years later. She disappeared in 37. The skeleton was found in 40. He measured it and looked at it, saw the skull. He would have seen those two dime-sized holes, but he reported no abnormalities. So that was one of their things they have said from Tiger that, you know, was evidence. But again, I like Ron Bright and late Patrick Gass's research into that operation.
Now, Rob, I want to move on to some local stuff for you for the Minnesota area, particularly St. Paul. There is an Amelia Earhart house in St. Paul, Minnesota. Is there not?
Yes, there is. It's on Fairmont Avenue, but I never give people the address.
Les Kinney visited it, right, in 2017 here?
Yeah, Les Kinney and I took him there to show him the house, and we went there, and there were two teenagers on the lawn texting away. And Les said, do you know that is this her house? And I said, yes. And he said, do you know that Amelia Earhart lived here? And I said, yes. So he asked if he could take some pictures, and they said, sure, go ahead. So they took some pictures. And then as we were leaving, he said, wait a minute, Rob. And he said, wait a minute. And he went back and he talked to a girl. He said, you know, you could maybe look around up in the attic. Sometimes high school girls might have a note with their name on it, or a secret message, or a little poem, or boy, if you could find something like that and had Amelia Earhart's name on it, it'd be worth thousands and thousands of dollars. So then we left. The first time I went to the house there, I went up on a porch and I talked with the owner, and we talked briefly. I showed her my flyer. I give children's programs about Amelia Earhart and also about her disappearance. And we sat on a swing on her porch and talked about it. And I asked if I could just please go in and look around. And she said, you know, I would let you do that, but my daughter has the flu. So I never did get a chance to go in and see it. And then I made a formal letter later on to try and get to see it, but they, you know, did not acknowledge that they wanted me to go in there. But I don't blame them. She said a lot of people stop at our door here and they say, Amelia Earhart lived here, don't they? So, you know, I respect her privacy. All I say is it's on Fairmont Avenue in the Crocus Hill area of St. Paul, but I have pictures at my programs of the house, but I never tell people the address so they don't bug them. I think they want to be left alone. So when I was given a program one time in assisted living, a woman said she was playing bridge with several other women, and she said, you'll never guess who lived here. And I said, who? Amelia Earhart. So that was kind of cute. Another time I was given a talk in White Bear Lake on, I know what really happened to Amelia Earhart. When the talk was over, they had the applause, and then a man stood up. And he stood up and he addressed the group. He started waving his hand. He said, "All that Rob said here and told us is true. I was on Saipan in 1944, and I had heard they had found her airplane." And his wife in the audience was nodding yes. So after the questions and answers, I went to talk with him, and she said, "Yeah, that's the first thing he told me after the war is they had found Amelia Earhart's plane on Saipan." Another man was in Hopkins, Minnesota, a suburb of Minneapolis. And he came up after the program and he said, "You know, I was an artilleryman. I was called a casual. They had me held over on Saipan for a while before going over to Okinawa." And he said, "Yeah, I heard they had found her plane there." And then just about 2 months ago, a man said they were steaming through the Marshall Islands on a boat. And an officer pointed to an island and said, "That's where Amelia Earhart was held." But I did not write down a man's name or anything because he could not recall what island it was. And boy, there's a lot of islands in the Marshall Islands. You know, was it Kwajalein? You know, what was it? So here's two local people that had seen, that had heard her plane was on Saipan when they were at Saipan. So very interesting.
Let me ask you this to sort of wrap up the interview. I want to ask you about impact and legacy because that's we can't really let any interview go by without that. It's coming on the 81st anniversary of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. I want to know really what you feel is Amelia Earhart's impact and legacy in 2018. Why is it, it's really a two-part question. What is her legacy and why is it that the world continues to be so fascinated with this case?
Amelia Earhart is very easy to like. If you start reading any of her biographies and stuff, she had a great sense of humor. She definitely was ahead of her time as far as how she dressed. She had her own line of clothing. She sold Amelia Earhart lightweight luggage. She was a speaker that made like $1,500 a talk many times, and that was a lot of money at the time. She really pushed women's rights. She encouraged women to not just stay home and have children, but to go out and do things that men do. She really was a trendsetter, and she was really ahead of her time. I kind of fell in love with Amelia Earhart, basically, when I started reading the biographies about her. She was just such a nice person and kind person and everything. You can't not but fall in love with her character. She really did a lot. Now, I have a friend here. Her name is Vicky. She lives in Marine St. Croix near here, and she flew DC-10 jets for, probably 10 years. She'd fly out of Minneapolis to Hawaii to Tokyo. That was her daily run, and she did that for a long time with these big tri-jets with these three engines. And she's about maybe 5'6", 5'7", or something. She's short. I asked her one time, "How did you ever get an interest in flying?" She said, "I read a book about Amelia Earhart, and it was so inspiring, I thought I would give it a shot."
Wow. Well, I think that's really the best way to end this conversation. Rob, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. And, thank you for being a Chasing Earhart guest. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate being on.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join us next week when we sit down with project guest Andy Sherrill. Thanks for listening.